Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino, makers of Domino One, the all-in-one cloud-based e-learning authoring tool for teams. You can learn more at domino.com. That's DOMINKNOW.com. Now, here's this week's episode.
Here we go. Wednesday morning.
It's Wednesday. We have coffee. We got that jamming, walking bass line in our ears. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Check out all the weather in the chat. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's probably warming up in Canada, yeah? No?
He's frozen.
Yeah. The internet's running slow because of all the icicles.
That's it. The squirrels have chosen not to keep the treadmill running, charging all the batteries. Well, it happens. Hey, Chris, we have a guest today. What's happening?
We do indeed. Folks, we have Guy Wallace joining us again. Guy, you've been with us before, but there are probably some folks in our collection here today who haven't met you before. So give us introduce yourself to the gang, would you?
Yes, thank you. I'm Guy Wallace. I've been in the instructional systems design, now known as learning experience design, world since 1979, and I've been a consultant to primarily Fortune 500 companies, et cetera, since 1982. I'm semi-retired now because I'm 69 years young, but I'm here to share some of my thoughts and experiences with you today.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're semi-retired because every once in a while I see a picture in the middle of day of you somewhere with your dog, and it's like, he's not working today. He's not in the office. He's off on a ramble.
That's my supervisor, and occasionally he needs to take me out for a discussion, a talk.
Very good, yes.
Improve my performance.
That's right. It's the contemporary 360 feedback cycle. A
lot of barking. A lot of barking.
Yeah, he's got that look on his face like, got a minute?
So, boss, how was the week?
Rough.
Oh, geez.
Oh, my goodness. But we are talking about, I mean, you know, speaking of, you know, feedback loops and making things better and those kinds of things, we are talking about performance improvement today, which is a topic that's long been near and dear to your own heart, Guy. And you know, our official title is Shifting from Instruction, to Performance Improvement. So maybe let's just throw out a little bit of a baseline. You know, how is performance improvement different than instruction?
Well, performance-based instruction or training or learning is often conflated, I think, with performance improvement consulting. So in my view, performance improvement consulting looks BBII. Beyond but including instruction. And by instruction, I mean both job aids and training or performance support and learning experiences or resources and courses. So we've got a lot of different names for these kinds of things. And, you know, I guess I would quibble with the conflation of performance consulting, which to me, when I read more about what people are talking about, they're really talking about performance-based kinds of instruction or learning experiences focused on, you know, the authentic performance requirements that people have back in the job. But I differentiate that performance improvement consulting. And I guess what I would be talking about today is the pivot point in an instructional systems design or instructional design or SAM or ADDIE or whatever project where you would pivot. There's a particular point where you would pivot to perhaps a non-instruction, a non-learning kind of a project, because the data that you've gathered, the analysis data or discovery data, more than suggests that, you know, addressing knowledge and skills isn't going to solve the problem and or opportunity that exists. So, you know, there's a particular point when you do that. And so you've got to kind of set up your approach to a project so that you will get to that pivot point with the right kind of data, credible data, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you might be starting in one place. I mean, we've all got the experience of, hey, we need training. Here's a PowerPoint, or here's a, you know, the documentation or whatever. We need to train people. We think it's 3 days training. Go make it, and then make it happen. You know, etc. But that's the folks giving us those orders aren't always, savvy to all of the things that we can actually, you know, do for them and even, you know, do better in a given context.
Yeah, I think back when I first appeared on your program here back in September of 2020, we talked a little bit about this, but I have a saying that, you know, a request for training for new hires should be expected. A request for training to solve a performance problem should be suspected. but I've also, you know, I'm an old guy, so I go back to something that I learned from the late Joe Harless back in 1985, and he was speaking at a conference and he was up on stage. And I think he was getting a little bit tired of people and this mantra, you know, don't be an order taker, push back, you know, and he didn't like that. And he said, you know, when he gets a request for training, he would always say, yes, I can help you. And I can help you a little more if you'll let me do this front end analysis. And then he would go on to quickly describe how he could quickly do analysis, avoiding analysis paralysis, which is usually one of the reasons why clients and others don't like, you know, analysis, because it's, you know, too often we're trying to, you know, boil the ocean for a cup of tea, as they said in the quality movement back in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's part of, I'm against pushing back and challenging the requester immediately. You know, I think the appropriate thing to do is say yes and honor that request, and then set your project up in such a way that you will generate credible data that will either show you that knowledge and skills are something to be addressed. And of course, if the request, because we have new hires and they need training because we don't have anything for them, then of course you're going to do that. But even in that kind of a project, you can uncover, you know, performance issues, opportunities or problems, and the root causes, the probable root causes of those things, so that the client can know, you know, what they are. Because when you're training new hires or, you know, anybody, things aren't rote. They aren't, you know, 1, 2, 3, ABC. They're that simple. Usually there are barriers to performance out there in the performance context. And it kind of behooves us when we're doing the analysis or discovery thing to uncover those and work with, get a chance to work with master performers, we can help elicit from them, what are those barriers? How do you avoid them in the first place? And just as importantly, how do you recover from them in the second place, should they be unavoidable? And so there's that tacit knowledge that experts have that we need to share with the new people so that they can avoid barriers or deal with them, you know, should they be unavoidable. And so that's all really important. And some of those times your barriers are things that, you know, your client isn't, you know, charged with that part of the business. And so they can't go make a change. They can't make that improvement. We can all see it, point at it, but it may be it's cheaper to live with the problem than to fix it. And so there's all these different, you know, situational things that we need to begin to understand. And our goal is to help the learner become a proficient performer. And we need to understand what's that performance requirements, and then what are those barriers, and how to think about all of that, and what knowledge and skills you need in order to perform. But there's that pivot point also where the analysis data points clearly, and I've had this happen to me several times in my career, where my clients look at the data that I read out to them, and I already knew this kind of a thing was coming. They're going to look at it and go, you know, continuing on the old training track is not the appropriate thing. We're going to spend a lot of money and time on that stuff, but our problems or opportunities, flips two sides of the same coin, I think, are that, you know, we have process problems. We don't have a process, or the process is deficient itself. And we need to go fix that before we train people on the old process, because the process ain't no good. So You know, so we can help our clients uncover those things, and then they can make the business decisions as to whether or not to pivot from an instructional design project to a performance improvement project to deal with processes or other environmental factors, like the data is no good that we have out there, or the equipment and tools are no good, you know, whatever those situations, environmental factors might be. Or they can say, you know, we need to go on both tracks. We need to continue with the instruction because we got these new hires, but we got problems to solve. So let's do both. And then, of course, we'll have to update the training or instruction at some point in the future. But, you know, we need it now. So those are business decisions that the clients are, you know, in a position to make a decision as to what we should do. And it's I think our charge should be to help them, bring them on the journey, as they say, so that they can see the analysis data. And if they handpick your sources for it, the people and documents and, you know, what you might have observed, they can, you know, believe the data and then take the appropriate action from a business standpoint.
Can you give us, talk a little bit about one of your examples that might stand out, and just drill down into just a little bit of details for us on this? Because I know a lot of times when I see people talking about this on social media, or I'm having conversations with folks about this, right? You know, the three of us have been in this industry for a collective decades, right? And so we get it. We know what we're talking about, but there are so many new people coming into this field, and I think they get overwhelmed when they see on social media or on podcasts like this that we're the real hot, these high level conversations about, you know, instructional design in a general way, performance improvement in another way. How can we bring that down and maybe start and just walk us through as simply as you can? I know it's super complex. That's why these conversations are always hard when you're doing it. But what does it look like when you go in, you know, and try to figure that stuff out?
So to me, the secret sauce is having the client and a group of stakeholders handpick master performers. Now, others call these people subject matter experts, but I want people who actually are masters at the performance that we're focused on. So I always have a performance focus, not a topic focus, not a behavior focus, but performance, which is to me outputs that are produced, deliverables that are produced by tasks, and those tasks are enabled by knowledge and skills. So I always start off my analysis after defining who's in the target audience, who's the primary audience, secondary, tertiary, you know, who are we really targeting? Because, you know, we may be looking at a process and there may be five different jobs in there, but one job is the critical one. So I need to get clear with my clients on that as a collective group, because sometimes they're not clear on that. And so it's one of those things where you just need to clarify. And then you can look at the performance, and then you can chunk out performance. Now, I'll use the ADDIE model as an example, even though a lot of people hate ADDIE, and I adapted it decades ago. But let's say you're gonna focus on the A and not the two Ds, the I and the E, and you're gonna scope in on that. So you wanna know, so what are the outputs produced when you're doing this analysis thing? Well, we might decide at the very end, near the end, we have an analysis report, and we may have a presentation to the client group. So there's two outputs there at the end that you've got to produce. Those are the physical, tangible kinds of things. And sometimes there's intangibles like concepts and ideas. But so you might say, well, in the analysis, are there any other outputs that you produce along the way? And one of them might be, yeah, we produce an interview guide. Okay, so there's an interview guide, and then we produce interview data. All right, and then you do this and you do that and you do that, and then you wrap it all up and put it in an analysis report so you can define what are the outputs that people need to know how to produce. Once you've got that clear, you can go back and say, well, how do you measure them? How do you know a good interview guide from a not so good one? You know, a non-example. We used to call them bad examples back in the day, but then we were told we can't use that. So we want to know what are the measures, who are the stakeholders, who gives a darn, and what are they, you know, so what's important to them about that interview guy, and then the interview data. And so there, you know, so then you get that really clear that, you know, the interview data has got to be a balance of the, all the personas out there that you're going to be, you know, trying to affect with instruction at some point. And then on and on and on. So you can divine these measures. So you understand, here's the output. Here's how we know a good one from a bad one. Okay, good. Now let's begin to look at tasks. So this is where task analysis comes in. For each and every output, what is the task set? macro tasks, micro tasks, whatever your need is downstream, you need to go after, you know, the big tasks, or you need to get really micro, you know, set the margins on the Word document or whatever. You know, so you got to articulate the tasks, and then you can define, you know, so what are the various roles and responsibilities? Is this one job doing it? There are several job titles doing that. Who's doing what? Where are they collaborating? Where are they going off and doing things on their own? Just to clarify, what's that performance? And then that's, I think, painting the picture of ideal performance to me. Now, I learned this back in 1979, a slightly different language at the time, because we were using typewriters then instead of work, you know, word processing equipment and computers and such. You know, we were limited in how we could portray this data when we generated our reports, but we would establish that ideal performance. This is what master performers are doing. And then we can ask master performers, so what are the non-master performers struggling with those outputs and those measures and those tasks? And they can tell us, because generally they know where other people are struggling. They've sometimes been asked to help other people out. So they've had to coach Guy in the past when he was screwing things up. And so they kind of have a sense of that.
But and how long, let me interrupt you just for 1 second there, just sure. To kind of, because I'm thinking like people in our chat might be thinking. And so what, as I just know from personal experience, right? When somebody brings you in and says, we need some training, you know, how do you then shift their mindset to, well, let's do all of this other stuff? Or how long does all that take? If you start, I know I've gone through this process, and at the end of the day, we just did training. But you say, you know, well, let's talk about performance, you know, and all those things that you just mentioned, right? What's the goal? Well, let's break down all the tasks. Let's do all this. When we're talking about how much time that takes, when we're talking through that, that sounds like a lot of work. You got to get all these people together. You got to get these master performers together. You got to do all this stuff. And at the end of the day, they might just say, you know what? We wanted to bring somebody in that would just take this notebook and turn it into e-learning for us. Don't think we really need all that.
Yeah. So if the stakes are high risk, high reward, then you might want to do this. If the stakes are medium or low, they don't want to do this. And so you just take what they give you and you convert it into instructional content. You don't die on that hill in that battle here because the stakes aren't worth it. But if the stakes are high, you can, you know, that changes the situation. I was a
it does. And that's a great way to put it, because I think that's the conversation you can have with executives and managers that don't really understand or care about the breakdown of the tasks and all that kind of stuff. They just have a problem and they need to figure it out. And I think that right there simplifies it. And it is a really key point, right?
Begin the analysis with them. You can say, so what do you want people to be able to produce once we give them this, you know, convert this content into instruction? What should they be able to do? How would we know that? So, you know, so I usually shift to, what would the practice with feedback look like? If we give them this and then you want them to practice this so you know that they're actually good at this. Oh, it doesn't matter, guy. Well, then we don't worry about that. But they say, well, yeah, we want them to really have that, you know, well in hand, because when they get back to the work, back to the job, you know, they need to be able to do this on demand. You know, is they've got to memorize this stuff, because I often ask them too, is this, you know, does the performance context require that they have a memorized performance response, or would it allow for them to have a referenced performance response? So can they use a job aid or performance support or a resource, look it up, and then, you know, perform, answer a question or whatever? Is there time and the place for that? Well, sometimes there isn't, sometimes there isn't. So I'm using that kind of a setup to help my clients begin to understand that maybe we need to produce job aids or performance support and not training or instruction or a learning experience. Because why are we asking people to memorize something when they can look it up on the job? I mean, you know, if they look it up on the job often enough, they'll soon memorize it. But if it's, you're doing the annual inventory and it's complex, we should give them a checklist of things to do and a sequence or whatever, and give them that guidance and let them perform that way. So there's, you know, so all sorts of devious tricks that you use with your clients on the front end to help them begin to reimagine their request, because they come to you, if you've got learning and development on the door, so to speak, Then they come and they look for you to do learning and development. Well, sometimes we don't need people to learn something. We really want them to perform, and they, learning may not have anything to do with it. In fact, since this is volatile content, perhaps we don't want people to memorize it because it's going to change maybe every week. And so we want them to follow some guidance, like a non-regulated standard operating procedure. You know, there's standard operating procedures that are highly regulated and you got to go jump through a lot of hoops and make sure they're valid and prove it and all that. And there's other things where we can get those people, here's a checklist of steps with a couple of key, you know, paragraphs in there to explain a little bit deeper than the, you know, the task statement that we might have put on there. Here's how to look at the output. Here's the criteria. So we can put all these kinds of things together and give that to people. And again, we're addressing knowledge and skills. I need knowledge and skills in the moment. You know, I couldn't recite to you the five moments of need, but I believe in what, you know, Bob and Conrad have, you know, put together for all of that.
Yeah.
And so what, you know, so what do we need to give people? Do we need to have them, you know, training or learning experiences where they memorize things because they've had a sufficient practice with feedback to shape their knowledge and skills, or hand them a document?
Mm-hmm. What kind of devious tricks do you employ when you're talking to master performers then about, you know, getting information from them to, that might help surface things beyond strictly, well, I do this, then I do that, then I do this, then that, you know, to be able to get a bigger picture sense of things.
Yeah. So it's kind of the Socratic process, if you will. And of course, that means you got to watch out for hemlock at the end of the day, because the generals did poison him.
I was going to say,
for them, right? So yeah, you might. For those of you who don't know the story of Socrates, you know, just beware. You know, so you're asking questions like a good lawyer that you probably know the answer to, or you're highly suspicious that you know the answer to. So you're asking people questions, taking them down the primrose path so that they arrive at the destination you think, where you say, you know, is it possible for people to memorize all of this? And your client might go, well, no, it'd be really hard. Well, if we gave them a checklist or a set of steps to do, would that be sufficient and they could perform it? Yeah, but yeah, so back in 1979, I was told on my first day on the job, we're going to do guidance, which was the Rumler Gilbert word for job aids back then. But our clients hated it. And so we had to embed guidance or job aids in the training. The training made the clients happy. The performance support made the learners happy because now they could go, I don't have to memorize all that stuff. I just got to read this and go do it. And boy, that makes life a lot easier when you're not forced to memorize things that you don't really, that you can't. But so you talk about, you elicit from the client the risks involved. So what's the worst case that's going to happen? Is it a safety issue? Is it a cost issue? Well, how much rework is there currently in the job? You know, do we produce garbage or we produce good stuff, or is it a mixed bag? So we may have master performers who can do this. It tells us it can be done, and we've got other people struggling with this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why are they struggling? What's the value in this? The whole memorize versus reference kind of response, is that okay? And then I start asking them about, so what are the outputs produced? And I've had to do this with client groups. I think I told the story in our last visit of 30 manufacturing operation managers, moms or mothers, as they call themselves, back at Motorola, who challenged me on doing analysis. And so I said, okay, well, so tell me about the job here. Let's paint a big picture of it. Let's do a big, huge block diagram on the flip chart, you know, 81. And they told me what the parts of the job that there were, and then they were arguing about that. Oh no, that part goes in the other part. You know, so they were all over the map, 30 of them. And that I knew that was going to happen. And so I asked them, so what are the outputs in this first one? So what are the problems with those? Well, they argued about that. And then I asked them about what are the tasks performed, and they soon ran out of their knowledge because they were 3-4 levels higher than the target audience. And so they knew, oh yeah, I guess we would have to tell them what tasks to perform and all that stuff. And we don't know. And so, okay. So, and I mentioned this last time too. So the head guy says, you know, you want to do this analysis? And he stopped me cold. And he said, guy, we hate it when people like you come back 90 days later and tell us what we told you on day one. And, you know, so, you know, I've heard that kind of thing before. So they saw no value add in the analysis that they had experienced in the past. So I said, well, this is what I'm going to get. I'm going to get these outputs and how you measure them and what the tasks are, what the difficulties are, what people find, you know, easy and hard. And then we're going to construct, you know, design the curricula, if you will, in a modular sense. So people who already know things can skip it. We can test them out, or you can just say, the boss says, you know, this, just skip it. And we can let people cherry pick what they need out of a menu of instructional content to help them do their jobs. And I would imagine, you know, and I say things like this, you know, thinking out loud, not afraid to be wrong or stupid, and say, I bet you some of these jobs require some things that the other jobs don't, because local control of the job, they said, no, guy, we don't want you to handle that report. I'm going to give that to somebody else. So your job doesn't even include that report, and so you don't want to put me through training like that. And I was dealing with manufacturing people, and so I try to relate to the client that I'm dealing with, whether they're sales or manufacturing or merchandising, and try to align things to things that they'd be familiar with, such as you have some products. This was the communication sector at Motorola. You have some products that have certain features on the product. You have like the Sears, you know, good, better, best. And the best has all the features, and the good has not all of them. And so you have a modular design, and some people don't need all the features. And so that's what we would do with the instruction. And they can go, okay, we still don't like you because you're from training, but you can go ahead and do this. And we have another meeting in 30 days. And so be there with the analysis data, because we're not going to tolerate 90 days. So you work with the clients. And one of the things that I've found, because I've had staff of 15 to 25 people in the past, and half of them were consultants, and they're expected to do analysis at some point on the job, is that people are afraid to defer the details till later. So part of my philosophy has been do a little analysis when I'm doing my project planning and kickoff of a project, do a little bit more when I'm doing the analysis phase. And when I'm going into my design phase, I add to the analysis data with additional analysis data that I generated then. And when I get into development, that's like the last point to get it all. So, and I typically defer the cognitive tasks, so the thinking that has to go along with the behavioral tasks. So when I get my outputs and my tasks, those are usually the behavioral tasks. Those are the kinds of things that we can see, we can count, we can measure, we can time them. But the thinking that goes along with those things, which is necessary to give to the new, to the learner, if you will, we can save that till we get into development. Because I've had in the design phase, I've had half of the design thrown out and said, we don't want you to cover that. We want you to cover just, you know, A, D, and E. Skip that B and C stuff. And so we go, oh, okay. So good thing we didn't boil the ocean for every last bit of details about B and C, because we don't need it now. And so we go into development knowing exactly what's been approved from a design, configuration, content, objectives, blah, blah, blah. And so now we can go capture all that in great detail. And if you have the anchor of the behavioral tasks, you can then begin to elicit, and this is tricky, but you can begin to elicit the thinking before, during, and after a behavioral task. So what are you thinking about before you do that? What are you thinking about while you're doing that? What do you think about that when you're done before you go on to the next task? You know, what is there? And that's all deals with the non-conscious knowledge. Sometimes people can give you some of that, but they can't give it all. The research, according to Richard Clark, suggests that, you know, experts will miss 70% of what a novice needs. But if you talk to enough experts, their 30s overlap, and so you can get closer to 85%. And so, you know, all is not lost. And then you do, you know, Bob Mager taught us all way back in the 70s and 80s, you know, test, test, test. You know, just because you put something together doesn't mean it's going to work. So you go do the testing of it. So sometimes that's like the minimally viable product that you put out there. But you put it out there to test it to see what's missing, what's wrong. So we're always striving in our instructional data, content, and the data that leads to that for accuracy, completeness, and appropriateness. So accuracy and appropriateness is usually the easy things to get. It's that completeness issue. How do I make sure that my data is complete? Because I'm dealing with people who only know 30% off the tops of their heads, and they can't give you that other 70%. They've automated that knowledge. They don't even know it. They can do it, but they can't tell you what they're doing. They just do it automatically. It's like, you know, when you're driving a car or something, you're not consciously thinking about every last move that you make.
Yeah. In the chat, Kim has posted in a really neat idea. One question I use with SMEs is, what would people be surprised to know that you do? This often gets to tacit knowledge. That's a really cool, it's an invitation to, as opposed to simply strictly answering my questions. It's an invitation to, you know, open up and help reveal something. That's very cool.
Yeah, when you're working with, I like to work with a team. I have a facilitated group process. I've been doing this, a group forum, teams, if you will, since 1979. So when you get together a bunch of experts that do the job, you'll find that they are always correcting each other. And guy, you dummy, you forgot two steps. Didn't you? Here, in between your step two and three, don't you also do this? And then you do that. And everybody else in the room goes, oh, aha. Yeah, that's right, guy. You got that. You know, so I've gotten to the point where I have to encourage that, but tell people, you know, I would joke with the team after a while, after we warm up, and say, so when you find out that I made a mistake and I've got something wrong, so when you say, guy, you dummy, what he's really saying to guy is that, guy, I think you've missed something. And then they laugh and chuckle, because I've had heated agreements occur. Have you ever seen a heated agreement where 15 minutes of arguing back and forth, somebody says, well, do you mean such and such? And the person goes, of course, that's what I mean. And they go, oh, never mind. You know, we were arguing about semantics. So it's the language, because people use the same word to mean different things and vice versa. So that's one of the things that we who do analysis, either one-on-one with a series of interviews or in a group forum, we're always struggling with that. You know, because on the West Coast, they call it something different than on the East Coast, and never mind the Midwest, because they got five different words for that. So we're always trying to navigate the language and labels that people put on it, because unless it's been formally documented and declared and shows up all the time, people create names for things because they've got to. They got to communicate locally. And that doesn't mean that, you know, one tribe to the next, one division to the next in an organization is going to call everything the same, because most processes are informal. They're not, you know, articulated. They're not mapped. They're not managed. They're not measured. But people do them nonetheless. And so we're in there trying to understand processes that vary tremendously, because we might find that, you know, when we uncover a problem, it could be, well, you know, what I learned from Gary Rumler back in 81 was, one, is there a process? If there is, two, are people adhering to it? And if not, why not? Well, because the process is stupid and it takes too long, and I can do it much shorter if I do it this way. So you're trying to uncover all that. So I always like to start with the process, you know, those outputs and tasks and blah, 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 and understand, is there a common process that everybody's using? And yes or no is the answer. And you kind of start from there, because maybe that's what we need. That's all we need. We don't need any training. We need a new process and something on the wall that says, you know, here's the 10 steps, do it. You know, it's a job aid on the wall or on a smartphone, and people can then perform and meet the stakeholder requirements.
This the idea of shifting from instruction to the performance improvement, I'm guessing the actual tasks and thinking this through from an external perspective versus an internal perspective, all the same. But when you're working internally, if you're the manager of a training department, you got a whole bunch of other responsibilities, you've got internal corporate politics, you've got all that kind of stuff. But what you do have on your side is time, because you're there, you're in it. You don't have other clients that you're also dealing with, or, you know, all the other stuff that comes with being an external consultant. So when you're internal, so there's these trade-offs. What, you know, it's easy, I think, for managers of training departments to fall back on, we just need an LMS, we need an authoring tool, we need, we need some instructional designers, and then we need some developers, or we need to contract this out, and to just kind of start thinking like that, like, I'm going to build this entity, and these are all the things that need to be built in that entity. And we're going to create all of this stuff, all these artifacts that are instruction. Is it because it's easier? I don't know why, but thinking about how people can start to move or shift up in that direction of performance improvement is one part of the question, but just knowing that there are some times where you still have to build that instruction, right? And staying down there and having people that do just focus on building that instruction, I think is a good idea.
We don't need to, talk to people as if, hey, you're building instruction. What's wrong with you? You know, so because new hires need it. Right. I mean, so if you don't have any training for your job, I mean, Deming would go crazy over the quality. The late quality guru would talk about this. People need to be trained for their jobs. Bottom line, if you haven't trained them informally, socially, formally, however, you know, they need that. And so you can't start picking on them if they don't know, if you've not told them, you know, what to do, how to do it, et cetera. So some form or fashion you need to do that. It's when you're asked to solve a problem and you look at it and go, you know, Bob Mager had this non-politically correct joke. If you held a gun to their head and they could now do it, you don't have a knowledge and skill deficit. You have a motivation issue. So, you know, so excuse me for being non-politically correct with that. But that was how the acid test back in the day of, maybe that's the case. Maybe the consequences in the consequence system punish people for doing the right thing. Now imagine that. So that you would want to go and re-engineer the consequences. And that was the second thing I learned from Gary Rumler. You focus on the process first, then you look at the consequence system becomes, you know, 8 times out of 10 or some number. There is the root of your problem, is that you've not got a process in the first place. So you have all this tremendous variation that's causing problems, or the consequence system is punishing people to do the right thing, to do a good job. How do we punish people for doing a good job? We give them more work than the person who fumbles and stumbles with it, and we punish them, and eventually they get smart and they back off. Now, all of a sudden, we're not performing as we used to do because Guy has slacked off because he figured out that the better he does, the more work he gets, and how unfair is that? You know, so, but there's many other issues too. So, so you got to produce, you know, the baseline, if you will, instruction, give people things for doing their jobs. You got to decide, should I leave this to informal learning? Is that sufficient? Should I up social learning from informal social learning to more structured on the job social learning with a coach, any coach, a designated coach, a certified coach? You know, so how do I get that done? Or do I need to send them to some formal thing, some e-learning, some virtual classes, or, you know, face-to-face classes? You know, what's required? And there's a lot of variables there, and you can figure that out. So you need to provide that. But it's when you get these other requests, or when you're dealing with that, when you're dealing with the baseline instruction that people need, and you uncover there's these problems, you help the client. So you don't push back on, Joe Hartless, the way he said it was, are you sure it's a training problem? You know, and everybody laughed at the conference because he said it that way. And he said, say yes. Do the analysis, let the data chips fall where they may. We can all go, oh, the data suggests that, you know, it's not a knowledge and skill deficit, there's something else. We still need to train the new people because they have a knowledge and skill deficit on how to do the job. So we can continue at that pivot point with, you know, continue with the instructional development, the learning experience development effort, and or do the performance improvement first, or do them simultaneously. And those are business decisions because there's consequences, there's costs, there's timing, you know, of things when we make those choices. And so I don't believe that that's the job of anybody in the learning and development supplier side to make decisions that really are owned on the customer side. They live with the consequences of those kinds of decisions. They pay the freight, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So they get to call that tune as to whether we're going to do both, or one and then the other, or what? You know, I've had clients cancel major, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of a project because the analysis data told them, your problems are rooted in something other than knowledge and skills. And so they canceled my project, which I knew as I was reading out the data to them that that's what they should do. I've had clients also then, you know, defer a project. So when I deal with clients in what I call gate review meetings, a concept borrowed from the quality movement, you know, I always tell them at the beginning of the meeting, you have four choices at the end of the meeting. Kill this project because it doesn't make any business sense. My clients hate when I do that. Kill the project? Ah! But I want them to know that, hey, this is what we're talking
it's
about
an option.
From a business perspective. Yeah, so kill the project or defer it till something later on or put it on hold or modify the project that we've got because we've learned something and we need to modify it before we go. So kill it, defer it, modify the plan, and then do it, or full speed ahead. You know, and those are decisions that I want my clients to make because I want to share with data with them so that they can make those decisions. And those are then my marching orders. Whether you're internal or external, you can do this. We did this at Motorola. We did this at Wix Lumber back in the day. I've done this as an external consultant with clients. But you don't do this for every last project. You salute the request. You go and implement it. You let the analysis data tell you what should be done. And if you've got this relationship where you're bringing the client along and they get to check in and look at things, then they can look at that analysis data. And you might even suggest to them, I don't know about this analysis data stuff here. You know, let's take a close look at this. And they go, what? I'm busy. Oh, yeah. Ho. This doesn't make any sense continuing with this instructional design stuff here. Let's shift gears here and go address and put a process in place. Okay. So if you have master performers, I might be able to help you construct a new process. Can I write the software for the new process? No, we'll need to partner with somebody else. Do I run the gauntlet with the regulators to make sure the process meets their requirements? No, we bring in somebody from regulatory affairs and they do that. So, you know, I may or may not be in the lead of what happens if we make that pivot, but I can play a role, especially if there's going to be a need to update the instruction, the learning that goes along with it. So, you know, there's many ways that we can look at this, and we've got to be conscious that when our clients invest in learning experiences, it's an investment for a return.
Yeah.
I hear the music.
Some awesome observations in the chat. Two that I want to circle back to quickly. Netta mentioned having a code book is essential. We have plants all over the country that we do training for and always emphasize users to stop us if they don't recognize the terms. We develop a dictionary or code book that we incorporate into future trainings. And Tom's got a note in here. People not adhering to processes locally is a common feature in air crash investigation. That's a sobering perspective to throw in, but yeah.
If nothing else, we love sober. sober perspectives are always good when we're drinking coffee. Hey, everybody. Thanks again so much. Guy, thank you so much for your wisdom and knowledge. You know, drop your information in the chat. Tell everybody about your book real fast. Or books, plural.
I got a bunch of books. You can find me on Amazon on my author's page and check them out there.
Perfect. Cool. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Big thanks to everybody in the chat.
Have a good day. Indeed. I'll drop that in.